Hi, folks. Denise Howell here. And next up on This Week in Law, Amber McKinney joins me, Matt Curtis, and Mike Keyes. We're going to talk about In-N-Out's triple-triple, the potential pivot from the Eastern District of Texas, facial recognition and the new iPhone, and selfies with bears, all this and much more next on This Week in Law.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiL, This Week in Law with Denise Howell, Mike Keyes, and Matt Curtis. Episode 399, recorded September 15th, 2017. Equibot. Hi, folks. I'm Denise Howell, and you're joining us for This Week in Law. We're so excited that you're here with us this week. I have my two wonderful co-hosts and a wonderful, wonderful guest that we're very excited to introduce to you. First, please welcome back to the show, Mike Keyes with the Dorsey Firm in Seattle. Hello, Mike.
Hello, Denise. Great to be with you. This is going to be a terrific show. I'm super excited about it.
I'm super excited, too. Lots has been going on, and we've tried, as usual, to cram as much of it as we could into the rundown for the show. Also joining us is Matt Curtis, law student at Notre Dame. Hi, Matt.
Hi. Thanks for having me on again and joining you from D.C. today, and looking forward to going through all the great topics we have.
Me too. I guess DC is probably less exciting with the Game of Thrones season over, and I guess the pop-up bar, is it still there? Do we know?
I mean, the sun's still shining, but it just doesn't feel like it. So
I can imagine the fiery breath of the dragon gone from the city. I don't know. Maybe it's still operating. Maybe they're keeping things going.
No, it's closed. It's closed.
Oh,
I checked.
A sad summer thing. All right. Well, let's welcome to the show our wonderful guest, Amber McKinney. Amber is the assistant managing editor at Law 360, which is basically the news arm of LexisNexis. Is that right, Amber?
That's right.
And LexisNexis, for all of you non-lawyers in the audience, is one of the two behemoths in legal research and legal tools for the law office, how we all get things done on the back end in the legal world. So wonderful to have you, Amber. Your emphasis there at Law 360 is immigration, IP, international trade, media and entertainment, telecom, and tech. So you've got a lot that you're responsible for.
Yeah, that's a mouthful that you just listed out, but it's actually the perfect things to be on this show. So I'm really excited to talk to you guys today.
They are a lot of overlap with what we love to do each week. And Amber, too, is a podcast host in her own right over at Law 360. They have a podcast called Pro Se. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
My favorite thing to talk about is the podcast. So we decided at Law 360 that it would be a really good fit for not just our current readers, but more broadly because it's outside of our paywall. We cover so much legal news. It's almost impossible for attorneys to plug into all of it from our website. So we take the best stories from the week, a few that are a little offbeat, some that are just the biggest things that happened, and we talk about them in a fun way. So I'm hoping that some people will check out the podcast because I absolutely love doing it every week.
We're excited to give you a little bit more exposure. We were talking about before the show, you guys have about 20 episodes in the can, have just started this year. Matt Curtis on with us too. Is it in a similar boat? He's doing it on his own, not under the auspices of LexisNexis, but he is also a new podcast launcher in his Law Pint podcast. Did you record again, Matt?
Yes, but the editing process has not taken precedent. So I now have three that I have to edit and get up. So I'm more than willing to have Lexis takes me on and handle some of that, swing that. Also, Pro Se is possibly a better name than Law Pint, and I really like Law Pint.
Well, Matt, I can tell you, I listened to one of your episodes about patents because, of course, patents are right in my wheelhouse. So it was really a fun listen, and I hope to see you post some more. It's been really good.
Yeah, me too. Thank you.
Excellent. Yes, you guys talk off the show and see what you can do. I sense good partnerships ahead. Anyway, let's move ahead and talk about, we had to put copyright in the front of the show because there's a topic there that we are just dying to talk about. We know that you are all dying to hear about Face ID, and we're going to get there. But first, we have to talk about, of course, monkey selfies. So the Naruto case we suspected might settle. We were getting word from the parties and the court. The Ninth Circuit was told to put on the brakes and not issue a decision in the case because the parties were talking settlement, and they have settled. So PETA and photographer David Slater have settled their dispute over whether Slater was infringing on Naruto the Macaque's copyright. When Naruto, the Indonesian macaque, took David Slater's camera and took a picture of himself. I think Naruto is a he. I'm not entirely sure, though. Amber, I suspect that you will know the answer to that question. Anyway, the case has settled. We're left sort of up in the air on how the issue of whether or not animals can hold copyrights will survive this settlement. And we'll talk about that in a little bit more detail here in a moment. But Amber, I understand you've been following the case closely, as we have too. What will you do now that we no longer will have Naruto to talk about on our shows and in our general lives?
Denise, I might have to actually shed tears over the end of this case. It's been so ridiculous and fun and just really interesting to follow, not just because of the face value of a monkey taking a selfie, which is hilarious in and of itself, but there were just a lot of tendrils of this case that were really interesting. There was some sort of incendiary stuff about an expert witness that maybe stalked one of the people who work at PETA. That was an allegation at one point that led to some filings about whether or not PETA was qualified to be an adequate representative for the monkey. So this case just had it all. It was just really entertaining to follow.
It has been. We bid it a fond farewell, but the other shoe hasn't quite dropped yet, because as typically happens when parties have reached a settlement, they go to the court jointly. And sometimes settlement terms are confidential, sometimes they're not. At least one portion of this settlement is not confidential, and people will be interested to know that photographer David Slater, I don't know how Blurb factors into this. Blurb was also sued, and they were the company that published Slater's self-published book of photographs. But Slater has said he's going to donate 25% of revenue from the monkey selfie photos to charities focused on protecting and improving the welfare and habitat of crested black macaques in Indonesia. So that's not too surprising that they've decided to do that. They've also issued a joint statement that is pretty interesting when you consider it in the context, and we always do consider this case in the context of not just animals that might have rights, but other non-human things that are becoming more and more intelligent on a daily and weekly and monthly basis in our society. Listen to this. PETA and David Slater agree that this case raises important cutting-edge issues about expanding legal rights for non-human animals, they throw in there, a goal that they both support, and they will continue their respective work to achieve this goal. And then they go on to say, as we learn more about Naruto, his community of macaques, and all other animals, we must recognize appropriate fundamental legal rights for them as our fellow global occupants and members of their own nations who only want to live their lives and be with their families. So against that backdrop, I guess it shouldn't surprise any of us that the parties have also gone to the Ninth Circuit, which would have ruled on this. We talked about the oral argument before that court a few episodes ago. And they've asked that court to vacate the federal trial judge's ruling that found that Naruto could not own copyrights. The judge basically sided with the Copyright Office, who the U.S. Copyright Office, who has made that statement. And now the parties are asking the Court of Appeal to actually undo that part of the trial court's ruling so that this remains an open question and that the legal arguments that PETA was advancing in this case could conceivably be advanced again, despite what the Copyright Office has said. In other words, this would be just removing one little bit of support. There would no longer be a federal decision on the books where a judge had found no, animals can't hold a copyright. What do you think about that, Amber?
Honestly, I think, you know, PETA's getting more of what it wants here in terms of just having more publicity about this case and dragging it on further. I don't think there's a real argument that monkeys can have copyright rights. I'd love to hear what Mike has to say about that. But everybody we talk to, as we've written about this story many times, all just sort of laughed it off. The copyright professionals out there all said, you know, this is really not part of the Copyright Act. This is not something that's going to fly. We'll see how far it goes. I think people were honestly surprised that PETA even took it to the Ninth Circuit. But again, if you look at this through the lens of PETA's trying to push animal rights generally by keeping this very this case that's very easy to write about and people want to follow in the news. So I think they were successful on that level, but won't be on the copyright arguments.
Mike, what do you think about the Ninth Circuit being asked to basically reverse the trial court, even though on that particular narrow issue, even though the case is now settled?
Yeah, it's not uncommon in my experience when two parties to a lawsuit resolve the suit short of a final decision by either a trial court or a court of appeals to ask for the court to not only not issue a decision, but vacate, in this case, the lower court's decision. So it's not uncommon by any means. As a matter of fact, I'd say it's quite common at this procedural stage to ask for vacature of the lower court's decision. It raises a couple of interesting possibilities for the Ninth Circuit. The Ninth Circuit could say, look, it's all well and good that you've settled, and normally that would moot a case, but this is an issue of potential importance that we think needs to be decided. I suspect that's probably not going to happen here. I suspect that the court will probably take note of the party's stipulated motion to dismiss and probably dismiss the appeal. The other issue is whether the Ninth Circuit will take that step and vacate the lower court's decision. I think PETA is asking, look, at the very least, if you're not going to vacate the trial court's decision, you should remand it to the trial court so we can ask the trial court to vacate the decision. You know, it's a bit of a controversial move in some respects because, you know, look, this is albeit a silly case. I agree with Amber wholeheartedly on that. And this was, I think, to a large extent done for publicity purposes. It does raise a novel issue with respect to copyright law that I think might be worth remaining on the books.
Yep, I tend to agree with you and am anxious to see what the Ninth Circuit does with this request. Matt, any thoughts?
Yeah, I'm just going to pull something off the chat, which Omega Project heard that Naruto refused to sign the settlement. So I just think that should be provided for the record here that the party who is apparently being protected is not able to sign this agreement, which is why he never or PETA never had standing in the first place. So,
right. Could be grounds for the Supreme Court to get involved.
You know,
if the Ninth Circuit doesn't recognize that. Yes.
That would be a reporter's dream. I would love it.
Absolutely.
Yes. Well, two years later, it appears this case, once we get this determination from the Ninth Circuit as to what they're going to do with the trial court decision, which said, no, sorry, monkeys can't own copyrights, and this monkey does not have standing for that reason, macaque, then it will be done. So I guess our first MCLE passphrase for this episode of This Week in Law will be farewell, Naruto, as Naruto rides off into the sunset, photographing lovely shots of it and himself or herself. Do we know gender? I knew at one point, I've forgotten.
I've forgotten to. Yeah.
Yeah.
Wasn't there a question of whether Naruto was Naruto at all?
There was.
That's right.
There
yes.
was a question about whether or not Naruto was correctly identified. Yeah,
we can't know its gender if we don't even know if it's Naruto.
That's right. I believe their monkey truthers were a thing in this case.
We are all Naruto, guys. We are all Naruto.
Okay, that's a better passphrase. I'm sorry, I'm amending the passphrase. We are all Naruto. The reason we put these phrases in the show is we have people who are interested in applying for MCLE credit in their jurisdictions. CLE stands for Continuing Legal Education, and lawyers and some other professionals who are seeking credit in their fields, I understand, do enjoy listening to our show and the educational components thereof to continue their educations and stay up to date on cutting edge knowledge that relates to what they do professionally. So we put these phrases in case your oversight board needs to actually have a demonstration that you watched or listened. We are all Naruto will be our first phrase for this show. There will be another one later on in the show. But before we leave the topic of copyright, as long as we're talking about gesticulating primates, we should not fail to mention Dr. Phil. Who has his own interesting copyright determination that came out earlier this month involving fair use. And it was a really interesting scenario where a woman who was suing Dr. Phil, a former employee of the show, copied some unpublished video from the show that she hoped would support her claims. Her claims involved emotional distress from alleged false imprisonment, where she said that she and other employees were locked in a room with Dr. Phil and he yelled at them and cursed at them and was not happy with something that they had done. So she sued over this. And before she left her job, I guess she was anticipating possibly suing over this because she copied some video that she thought would be helpful in proving her claims. I haven't dug deep enough to know whether the court even knows the content of that video or whether the video would have been helpful or not. But all I know about it is that it was unpublished video that was generated in the course of filming Dr. Phil's show. And Dr. Phil and his production company went out and registered a copyright in that unpublished video and proceeded to argue that it was infringement of her to not only, you know, violations of her employment agreements and everything else, but copyright infringement to have absconded with that video from the job. She countered that it was fair use of her to have and use the video in the way she intended. And a court sided with Dr. Phil and his production company and decided, nope, sorry, what you've got going on here is not fair use. So and went through the various fair use factors and described why. So it's an interesting case, both in its assertion of copyright to prevent the use and also in the way that the court analyzed fair use and decided it didn't apply. Mike, do you have anything that we've learned or can take away from this analysis?
Yes. So I actually just posted a blog piece on this yesterday. Mm-hmm. There's some very interesting aspects to this decision, some of which are troubling. I think one of the interesting, at least in my opinion, one of the interesting side notes here is that this was issued out of the Eastern District of Texas. And the Eastern District of Texas for many years was essentially the most popular venue for patent plaintiffs to bring their lawsuits. Historically had been very plaintiff oriented. Juries were very plaintiff friendly and patent plaintiffs would bring their cases in the Eastern District of Texas as a way to help leverage their lawsuit against these patent infringement defendants. The U.S. Supreme Court came out with T.C. Heartland just recently, within the last couple of months, which really limited the ability of plaintiffs to bring patent cases in the Eastern District of Texas. So on the heels of that, and I don't know if there's a relation between TC Heartland in this copyright decision. But we have what I think is probably one of the most copyright plaintiff friendly decisions that I've seen recently for a couple of reasons. One, as you mentioned correctly, Denise, the court denied the defendant's motion to dismiss, but somewhat surprisingly, the court sua sponte, meaning on its own, granted summary judgment to Dr. Phil and his production company. That in and of itself doesn't happen all that frequently, that a judge will issue summary judgment in favor of a party that never even moved for it. So that was kind of eye-popping. But then when you really get into the decision, it's even more of a head-scratcher because, one, the court said there's four factors, as you mentioned, and not to get too far into the weeds here, but a couple of aspects of it I think definitely bear discussion. The first factor is the purpose and character of the use. You know, for what purpose is the defendant using this alleged infringing content? She was clearly using it for purposes of documenting a judicial case against Dr. Phil and the production company. So I don't believe that there was evidence that she had motives other than that to profit from it, to sell it to the National Enquirer and other things like this. As a matter of fact, I think the court said there isn't any indication that she was engaged in kind of a for-profit motive here. It was purely to document her case, which I think is an important use for purposes of being able to, you know, establish legal rights and remedies against a party. So on that particular factor, the court sided in favor of Dr. Phil. And the other thing that's important is that the last factor, which is oftentimes considered the most important factor, is has that use adversely affected the market for the plaintiff's work? In other words, has this infringement somehow undercut the ability of the plaintiff to go out and license this work to others? And it doesn't always happen this way, but if the plaintiff can't show that there's an adverse effect on that market, you know, fair use tends to be found. And if the plaintiff can show that there's an adverse effect on the market, then fair use is typically not found. Doesn't always happen that way. But what's surprising here is the plaintiff could not establish that there was an adverse effect on the market. And notwithstanding that, the court still granted summary judgment for the plaintiff. So it's a very unique decision. I hope it does get appealed to the Fifth Circuit, and we'll see what the Fifth Circuit does with it. I don't think it was correctly decided. So that's my take.
Wonderful. And I'm just now adding your blog post to our discussion points for the show, since I didn't have it when I did the rundown for folks who want to read it and want a quick pointer, not just to Mike's post, but to everything else that we're discussing today. If you head over to tagpacker.com/user/thisweekinlaw, and find episode 399, you will find that post and everything, links to everything else we've discussed. We also have a Flipboard magazine if you're a Flipboard person. I'm D. Howell on Flipboard, and you can find the magazine there. It's called, logically enough, This Week in Law. Let's see. Matt, anything you want to add to this?
Yeah, and kind of drawing on what Mike just had to say is that prior to it being the patent venue of choice for plaintiffs, it was the methylphelioma litigation spot of choice. So this is you know, in terms of a court that's been captured by certain interest, is one that's tends to happen. And Judge Gillestrap was prominent in the patent case. Obviously, he got there after the methylphelioma. Lots of the cases being brought, but the second thing is that the characterization of what someone who's bringing a tort action against another individual and characterizing that within the copyright segment as being self-serving, and it's not that they're looking to you know, get to where they were previously. They're not looking to right the wrong that was brought to them, and that's what they're bringing the action against the tortfeasor for, that they characterize it as a profit-seeking. And they didn't go so far as to say that this was a commercial activity, but it was hedged in that light. And the case that they they likened it to was one in that went up to the Supreme Court. It was The Nation against someone who wrote a – bibliography or biography, and they took large sections of Gerald Ford's characterization of what happened between at the end of the Nixon administration and took it pretty much verbatim. And then they tried to get fair use on that, and they said that because the public would value this information, therefore I was able to take whole cloth the most valuable parts of this work. And the court ultimately said that no, they ran through the analysis and they said even though it's a public benefit for them to know this, they would have known it anyways in 2 weeks later when the book was going to be released, and this was just self-serving activity. That they characterize a plaintiff bringing a suit against another individual in that same sort of light is troubling, not just in a copyright suit, but in terms of, you know, looking for justice across a broad spectrum, that it just doesn't seem like you're going to get a fair hearing if that's how the judge is characterizing you.
Yeah, I see this case as a reminder in ways that some of the revenge porn cases were a reminder that copyright law is broader than you think and might apply in situations that don't intuitively seem like why the law was enacted. And this is a good example. In the revenge porn cases, people were sort of applauding, going, yay, thank goodness that person took that ill-advised selfie and shared it with their dirtbag significant other because now they own the copyright to it and they can DMCA the site, and it's a tool to get it taken down. But here we're seeing copyright used in a context where I think it would strike most people as saying, no, that's not why we have that law. Do you agree, Amber?
Yeah, I think this case is so interesting because of the connection to the Eastern District and to Gilstrap. So to sort of piggyback on what Mike and everyone was talking about before, Gilstrap didn't just have a strong interest in patents and took a lot of cases. It's a staggering amount. There were 4,500 patent cases filed last year, and Gilstrap himself heard 1,100 of them. So we're talking about it's almost more than a cottage industry. It's a domination of that area in the law. And there is some debate about how much TC Heartland will take out of Eastern District because they're fighting now about what it means to be a place of business and how that will be defined. Gilstrap has a very loose test, which many have construed as his way of trying to hold on to as many of those patent cases as he can. But if he sees this slipping away, there's an argument to be made that people will see this copyright decision and say, oh, well, we saw what happened with patents. Gilstrap was, and the Eastern District were seen as plaintiff friendly, and maybe they'll see the same thing as friendly to a copyright holder. And this case presents a very extreme version of that. It's unusual facts. They even did things like the video in question was about 9 seconds long from a much larger archive. And then they went and got a copyright on that exact length of the video. So that's a weird thing to then be able to argue as one of those four factors for fair use that, no, that this person's using the entire work.
Right.
And that's only because they copyrighted the exact amount of the work that she had taken from that archive. So it's little nuggets in this case like that that make it a really good one for people to watch and see if it does get overturned, if it's appealed to the circuit.
Do you think, Mike, Amber, or Matt, that the Copyright Office will start to be on alert for people registering copyright on tiny little portions of a whole, that it might start to frown on that practice? We'll start with you, Mike.
Yeah, I think that's probably going to be hard for the Copyright Office examiners to police. Unlike in the patent and trademark context, when it comes to copyright examination, I mean, really what the examiner is looking at is this subject to copyright protection, i.e., is it a work of authorship? And I really don't see an examiner getting into, oh, this is just a short video clip, because even a short video clip itself is subject to copyright protection. So, no, I think this is probably going to be more, it's going to come out in the wash in terms of judicial proceedings. I wholeheartedly agree with Amber that, I think it's very suspect to only register 9 seconds of what's a very much larger archive and then claim, oh, you copied the entirety of the work because that's all I registered. That's not how the analysis goes, or at least it shouldn't. Yep.
Amber, could you see the Copyright Office starting to, I mean, it's really, I think just reading between the lines of what you just said, it's gamesmanship to do this, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, that's the way it appears in the face of it. And I agree with Mike, it's very tricky to expect the examiners to be making these determinations because they're not following whether or not they're outside legal proceedings. And we have such an unusual set of facts here where the legal proceedings originated in employment law. So this was about whether or not she had the loss of her job had been precipitated by Dr. Phil acting badly, basically. And mm-hmm. So I don't know how the copyright examiners would ever square that in what they're doing when they're registering copyrights.
Right. Matt, any thoughts?
Yeah, I think this just brings up a good point about like the difference between copyright and patent law, in that patent law, you have to go and turn in your patent application in order to get a patent, whereas in copyright, you have copyright protections if your work is deemed copyrightable, whether or not you send in your application. And it's just incentives throughout the judicial proceedings that are looking to bring you into the Copyright Office, but you don't have to bring them in there. So, so that they sent it in for just 9 seconds means pretty much tells you that they were looking to go to court over this.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Well, very interesting. I love all your insights about Eastern District of Texas and what they may be positioning for here. We'll just have to wait and see if that pans out. It will be interesting to watch. Also interesting to watch this week has been how the FTC has released some new information and taken some new actions regarding influencers. So let's switch gears into talking about the social web. So as we know from covering our coverage and other coverage of the Fyre Festival earlier this year, the FTC is not sleeping on this issue of online influencers and their need to disclose their relationships with people who are paying them to plug, flog products or services or events online. The FTC did a post on its own site where it was alerting folks to three distinct developments, one of which is very important just to pass along for if you yourself might be an online influencer, if you know someone who is, if you are a lawyer who represents these people. The FTC has updated its guidelines and provided more concrete answers to its FAQ about how its guidelines will be applied. They say that they've given us, let's see, how many more? 20 new questions relevant to influencers and marketers on topics like tags in pictures, disclosures in Snapchat and Instagram, the use of hashtags, and disclosure tools built into some platforms. So if you are at all in this area of law, whether personally or professionally, definitely pay attention to these new guidelines and clarifications from the FTC. And then you'll also want to pay attention to actual steps, law enforcement related steps that they have taken recently, this time related to something we've talked about on the show before. Skins in the multiplayer online video game Counter-Strike Global Offensive, known as CSGO. Skins can be bought, sold, traded for real money. They have real value, like much material in games. Here, there were a couple of YouTubers who had been approached by a company that was gambling using skins for money, if I'm interpreting this right. And they got on board and started backing these YouTubers, and the YouTubers started promoting the company like crazy and saying how much money they'd made in a betting pool on the site, but they didn't concretely disclose that they were being paid by the site. Well, the FTC didn't like that at all, and not only took issue with the conduct, but took issue with the sort of sloppy grammatical usages in posts, such as, bruh, I've won like $8,000 worth of CSGO skins today on CSGO Lotto. I cannot even believe it. And the FTC comes out and says, well, bruhs, while we're on the subject of things we cannot even believe, did either of you like consider clearly disclosing that you like owned the company, a material connection requiring disclosure under FTC law? So FTC wasn't happy about this at all, and is taking according action about this. Not you, Mike, but one of your colleagues wrote this up at the TMCA.com, your firm's blog on these topics. Do you want to expand on this a bit for us?
Yeah, so this is a really interesting development. We've talked about influencers and the FTC, how active they are in this space. And I think this is a really good example. I mean, this falls into the what were they thinking category for sure. I mean, they clearly had a material connection in that they had an ownership with this site. They were acting as disinterested third parties, trying to get other folks to participate, all for their own material gain. So the FTC rightfully took swift action and took some very significant action here. So this is the first case, I think, it's being billed as the FTC going after the influencers themselves. T. Martin and Syndicate, they were the influencers that were trying to pump the site. And the order, as I recall, has some pretty significant provisions in it. They have to, T. Martin and Syndicate have to submit materials, submit reports to the FTC, have to confirm that they're going to disclose material connections, have to ensure that other influencers that they pay disclose material connections. And I think I've got this right, that T. Martin and Syndicate have to issue reports directly to the FTC and have to do it, I think, for 10 years. So it's like, wow, this is a massive ongoing obligation that these folks have. No question, this is a harbinger of things to come. The FTC is very proactive in this space and is really looking at social media influencers for sure.
Right. And they're not forgetting about you if you've crossed their radar. They mentioned that one of these YouTubers had been involved in a 2015 settlement with Machinima, where the FTC had alleged that he had pocketed $30,000 for two video reviews of the Xbox One, where he should have disclosed that he'd been paid to create and upload the videos, but did not, and it went away because of a settlement. But the FTC apparently does not forget, and I'm assuming was retributionally hard on the guy because he's a repeat offender. What do you think of all this, Amber?
I love this one. This is just a sign of our times, right? That we have all of these quote unquote influencers out there and they're not disclosing. I think this just has so many fun and interesting details about something that's really going to persist because these influencers have taken root and it's a way that companies are continually gravitating toward getting the word out about their products. So some fun things I think that are in here in that FTC guidance about what influencers should be doing, they have to spell out specifically things like, hey, don't use weird hashtags that no one knows what they mean and act like that's your disclosure, which I think is both funny just on the face of it, but it's also really interesting that already these influencers have tried to almost skirt the system because they would use hashtags like hashtag SP. That's it. That's all they would say. That means sponsored post, but what normal person would know that? So the FTC is saying, like, that kind of stuff's not going to fly. That's not really a disclosure, even if you think it is. So I think that's interesting. I think the other thing that's interesting that's happened this week is that Public Citizen did a FOIA request and got the results of that about who a lot of these warning letters were sent to. And it's a really, it's it's the list that I would have imagined. So on the one hand, it has a ton of reality television type stars. So it's got from Jersey Shore, it was Snooki and JWoww. It's got Scott Disick, who's associated with the Kardashians. It has Farrah Abraham, who was a teen mom. But then it's got some bigger name celebrities that are in on this sponsorship game as well. It had Lindsay Lohan, Sofia Vergara, Vanessa Hudgens. So there's a large contingent of famous or semi-famous people that really need to step up their game about being clear about this, because the FTC is not going to be letting it go.
Yep. Excellent point. And the other thing, by the way, that was the third thing that the FTC reminded people of, is that back in April, they sent a bunch of these warning letters out. And it's great that we now know who they went to. But in their guidelines, in their post about their guidelines, they also point out, I think they're sort of trying to get out in front of the fact that people who are famous enough to be leveraging their brand in this way may feel like their followers all hang on their every single post and their every single word. So if they said something about being sponsored by a brand long ago at some point in time, they don't need to do that again. And the FTC clearly says no to that. They have a hypothetical where someone's responding to them saying, but everybody knows. And the FTC says, no, they don't. It's unwise for influencers to assume that people know all about their business relationships.
Yeah, and that seems really reasonable to me, because as we all know, we're all in the social media space as well. It moves so quickly. And even if you are an avid follower of, say, Lindsay Lohan, if she posts three or four things a day every day, and that's a low ball number, the fact that she said she was a paid sponsor from some, you know, skin cream or whatever 6 months ago, no one will remember that. And even digging that up on Instagram or Twitter would be a Herculean endeavor for a consumer.
Yep, absolutely. Matt, are you going to change your social media activity accordingly to make sure that you have steered clear of these issues that the FTC is confronting here?
I don't think they're going to catch me with my maybe 50 followers now. But I do think that one thing that distinguishes this one from all the other ones that we talked about earlier in the year is that this has to do with online gambling, which is illegal in the United States. So this site had to have been operated out of somewhere like England, which allows for individuals to allow online gambling. And the 2006 Online Gambling Act makes it illegal, makes it a federal offense with pretty strict – I don't know exactly – can't remember exactly what the criminal offense is, but for operating or advertising for online gambling. So that they didn't disclose this may have actually saved them from harsher penalties. So this may have come about as an inability to prosecute them for actually advertising or actually operating an online gambling site, which is a multi-billion-dollar industry that is really in competition with state lotteries. So there's a lot of things at play here, which may have made the sentence harsher than someone just advertising their own company. Because I mean, if I'm advertising, you know, a pint of law on here and saying that, oh, you should go listen, that's not going to, you know, it just doesn't seem like that's something that someone's going to go after in the same way as someone who's running an illegal business that just happens to be hosted outside of the United States.
Yeah, that's the part of this that gets me even more than the fact that skins in Counter-Strike Global Offensive have real value. I guess I can wrap my head around that. You know, we've seen people mining for items in games for years and then attempting to leverage their activities into cash. But here, the gambling that was going on was challenging. So you have skins, someone else has skins, and you challenge one another to a coin flip and wager the pooled skins. So winner takes all. Who does that? Who has the time to sit around gambling their virtual video game skins in a coin flip? I don't know. Different
Matt
business models.
Matt and all of his law student buddies are probably doing that.
I guess. I don't know. I think it's hilarious. All right. right. So moving on, I don't want to spend a ton of time on this, but just want to mention it because I know it's been much in the news. There is not too much to discuss on the legal front. Of course, there could be at some point over this sort of bad PR debacle that Facebook is going through about what Mike Elgin in his piece at Computer World is calling DAS, disinformation as a service, cool coinage there, Mike, which referred to the internal investigation that Facebook did that uncovered 470 fraudulent Facebook accounts linked to a Russian troll farm that were buying ads, these account, costing around $100,000 during the recent U.S. presidential election. So, you know, bookmark this for future regulation over platforms like Facebook and Google and others as to, you know, them needing to do due diligence as to who is buying their ads. But more currently, I think it's super interesting that bots are buying ads, which is what Mike points out in his piece. And then even more so, Facebook refused to share the content of the ads, you know, which bot bought which ad, et cetera, with Congress and the media, citing its privacy rules. So Facebook, interesting point number two, Facebook is protecting the privacy of bots, privacy of users who don't actually exist, fake, false, fraudulent accounts. And then interesting point number three is a quote from Mike's article, where he writes, in the very near future, it is likely that the focus of IT security will be forced to shift from keeping information safe to keeping information true. So just all interesting offshoots from that development. Anything you want to add, Amber, to all of what went on here?
Yeah, I think that what we're seeing here is just we're in this cultural moment right now where this is taking center stage, where there's so much going on with quote unquote fake news and Russia interference on this front that I'm not at all surprised that there's a lot of discussion about it. But I think most people, when they hear about this, especially people that aren't following it closely, are going to have a bad reaction to the idea that Facebook and other service providers are not taking it as seriously as they could. Protecting a bot is a hard thing to justify to the public. I think even if you have good reasons from a privacy standpoint about it being a slippery slope and other things like that, I think it's going to be tough out there to sell that to the public.
I'm wondering, Amber, if you have you know, any unique perspective on this as the assistant managing editor of a news site overseeing, you know, the content that's going on Law 360, I'm sure it's very forefront in your mind that your sources are, you know, as valid as they can be these days and that you're not getting duped one way or another.
We spend a lot of time thinking about that and making sure that things are what they purport to be. I think for mainstream media outlets and even ones like Law 360 that service a particular audience, so it's a trade publication essentially, we still have the ingrained policies and practices of journalists. So we run into this problem actually less than people who are, say, bloggers, smaller outlets. Places like that have a lot more trouble because they don't have the vetting procedures in place. This is actually something we talked about on the Pro Se podcast that's going to come out this weekend. We didn't talk about this particular issue, but I just have an example of something a little silly, but it fits into this context. There was a local show in Wisconsin. It was Hello Wisconsin. And they got duped by what were essentially just comedian pranksters who sent out a press release and said, hey, we're these guys who do these workout videos. We want to come on your show and show everybody what we do. And it was a comedy routine. They were found footage people who like find old VHS videos from the 80s that people think are really funny. So the comedy duo has been sued by the station saying that they were in fact duped, that this was false use of their resources to come on the show for a purpose that was different from what they purported it to be. They have pushed forward in that lawsuit. The comedians have moved for summary judgment, but I think it's just a sort of a humorous example of how the smaller the outlet or the less used to dealing with vetting they are, the more easy it is for them to be duped.
Yeah. I mean, I could see where the station has some legal footing to assert fraud or intentional damage, you know, maybe defamation in some way, damage to their reputation.
Yeah, they've asserted fraud and misappropriation of the resources of the station. Mm-hmm. And the comedians in that instance, because it is a lighthearted subject matter for the dispute, basically said, the press release we sent you and getting booked on this show was so obviously a joke that you should have known that this is what was going on. But that's not going to be the case when it's something that's sent to intentionally deceive.
Yeah, fascinating. Interesting to see what happens there. On the flip side, I can see where the comedians, aside from just arguing, well, you should have known it was a joke, I might also argue, well, you know, you're a journalistic outlet. You have obligations to check if we are joking or not and vet that.
And there's some validity to that. There's two sides to this argument for sure. Mm-hmm. I think that most outlets take really seriously vetting stories, particularly from sources that raise any red flags. The question becomes, as places become more and more sophisticated, are traditional means of figuring out what is a trusted source going to start to crumble? We even see that it's not quite the same thing because it's still a traditional and trusted source, but we even see from Congress or the White House differing statements that say opposing things. And that's really tough. If Donald Trump says one thing on Twitter and then his White House staff says the exact opposite, it's a real quandary for the media to figure out exactly how to report that story.
Virgil in our IRC is pointing out that this is reminding him of Bart Simpson calling Mo the bartender repeatedly.
It's a lot like that out there, guys. It's a lot like that out there.
and you know, who knows? Mo might have a cause of action. Matt, any thoughts?
Just that, like, part of this just falls into the, like, I'm no fan of Donald Trump, but part of this just falls into the infatuation of, like, knocking him down and, like, anything with Russia is big news. Like, you got to remember that the total spending in election was, you know, according to The Economist, right around $5 billion. And the idea that even the best spent $100,000 could have done anything is a little bit preposterous. So I don't think it's a good thing that we have Russians, like, sending money for our politics or anything like that. But this is also, like, the smallest drop in the bucket.
Okay. Excellent point. I know that folks have been waiting to and wondering all week. There's been some good publications on the topic already, but we're going to get to it too. Next, we're going to talk about the iPhone X, iPhone X. I haven't quite resolved in my mind what we're calling the thing, and it's Face ID. I did watch the whole, well, almost all of the presentation earlier this week live on Twit with our Twit audience. I missed the watch part, which I understand was one of the best parts of the Apple announcement earlier this week and seems to have reinterested tons and tons of people in the Apple Watch. But the phones have all kinds of interesting aspects to them. And from our perspective, from the legal perspective, the new way of unlocking the iPhone X, all right, they're telling me, Stoic Squirrel is telling me in IRC to call it an X, so I'm calling it an X. Apple won't tell Stoic Squirrel what to call it, so I'm calling it an X per his instructions. It has Face ID, where it has 3D mapping of users' faces. I haven't seen detail on whether you're going to be able to have multiple faces able to unlock a phone, but I assume based on the biometrics that Apple has used in the past, you can have multiple fingerprints, multiple persons' fingerprints unlocking one phone. So I assume you could have multiple faces unlocking one phone as well. But the question then becomes, okay, we're going to have 3D facial maps, which Apple says are going to be very hard to spoof. Part of the presentation involved a rather creepy clip of latex masks that supposedly were used in testing Face ID on the iPhone X, and a discussion of how various special effects artists were consulted to try and fool the system and to train the system so that it could not be fooled by such ruses. So, you know, it remains to be seen. The thing hasn't been released yet. And someone in IRC, as we were watching live on Twit, pointed out that, you know, maybe give the hackers a week until they're able to break Face ID. And that's a good point. You know, how long will it take for it to be compromised in what ways? But assuming that it works and works as planned and can't be spoofed with things like photographs or masks, it still raises lots of questions. One of the questions that lots of people are concerned about is, okay, so we've got all sorts of uncertainty, strange laws, strange judicial decisions around when passwords and passcodes and fingerprints can be required to be given, when a forced unlocking can be ordered by a court, how will Face ID fall into that rubric? It seems like it would fall on the side of fingerprints rather than passcodes. There is disagreement in the world of legal scholarship about that issue. There's disagreement about whether there should be this demarcation. We've talked a lot about that on the show. I believe we just talked about this last week with Judge Tom Delahanty. But we're back into it with this Face ID issue because what everyone is envisioning is a police officer holding the phone up to your face and unlocking it that way and accessing your material. Now, that kind of scenario is certainly a hazard, probably more at the border than it would be out and about in your daily life, because for that kind of thing, as we discussed last week, a warrant would be required. But still, if you're going through the valid legal process, could someone force you, could a court force you to unlock your phone by providing your face? And if the analysis goes along the lines of fingerprints, and I don't see why it wouldn't, it seems like that's where this would fall, that a passcode is going to be more secure for you, less prone to be ordered to be forked over than something associated with your physical being, be it a fingerprint or a 3D image of your face. Do you agree with me on that, Mike?
Yeah, I do. As we've talked about before, that it seems like the line of demarcation is if you're being compelled to disclose something that you know, that raises a Fourth Amendment or Fifth Amendment issue. Whereas if you're being compelled to provide something that you are, i.e. a hair sample, blood sample, fingerprint, then that is not considered testimonial. It seems as though facial recognition, that would fall on the side of the line about who you are as opposed to something that you know, seems to me. But of course, as we've talked about before, the lines are a bit fuzzy here.
Mm-hmm. Senator Al Franken has asked a bunch of questions to Apple, and they're all really good questions. Apple, during the presentation, has said that, and subsequently, I believe, has said face recognition data is only going to be stored on the individual phones and not stored in the cloud, not on a server. So that's somewhat comforting. But Franken is interested in whether that data can be accessed remotely or through physical access to the device, and whether Apple may at some point change its stance on that and is asking for assurances that this data won't be stored centrally and converted into this vast database of 3D maps of people's faces. I mean, it's certainly something to try and wrap your head around and be concerned about. Other good questions from the senator involve, let's see, he had lots of them. Whether, hold on, looking at his questions, the security of the system, whether it's sufficiently trained, the Face ID system, and he's looking at the accuracy of the system. So I guess he's looking at down the road, whether the system is going to be subject to false positives. So assuming that somebody does use this data for something, I think he's worried that it might misidentify someone. So lots of questions for Apple as it begins to roll out this product. Amber, what could go wrong?
So many things could go wrong here. I think that it's a tale as old as time that we're dealing with right now, where a new technology comes out and the things that have happened in the courts and the things that have happened on the regulatory side are going to scramble to catch up to the technology that's being developed and deployed. So I think Senator Franken's questions are really valid ones about everything from whether or not law enforcement can get access to phones in this way that you guys have talked about on this show before. But I thought it was really interesting that he directly asked about whether or not this data would be stored in the cloud. And as more and more things move to the cloud, that's a really good question. It's very few steps away from essentially a national database of everyone in America. He also asked questions about if Apple would be collecting data that was these face recognition data points, and if that could ever be sold to a third party. Because as we know, terms of service often hide lots of things in them about what you agree to give up to the company. So he was essentially asking, are you ever going to have in there that Apple can sell these data mapped faces to another company? And that's a really interesting question.
Yeah. And I mean, how does Apple say, you know, no, we will never do that? I mean, I suppose it's a promise that they could make. And given who Apple is and what sort of company it is, it's one that people could put some faith in. But any company, Apple's certainly had its financial vicissitudes over the decades. And at some point, it may need to sell assets. And when it sells assets, is it going to be able to enforce agreements that it's made about what it's going to do data? I mean, these are open questions for any company. Also an open question at this point is whether the emergency feature that we discussed last week that's coming in iOS 11, where you can disable the fingerprint reader by a 5-time tap on the wake sleep button, whether that's going to also disable Face ID. I assume, Matt, that it would, don't you?
Sorry, say that question again.
You know, you remember we talked about how in iOS 11, there's an emergency feature. It's being called the cop button, but you can envision lots of other scenarios where you might not want your phone to just automatically open itself up by putting a finger on its reader or by flashing it at your face. And in iOS 11, this feature is coming that would disable Touch ID. But it remains to be seen whether it will also work to disable Face ID. It seems to me like it would be inconsistent and silly not to have it be able to disable that, right?
Yeah, it would seem very inconsistent that they would, a week before, put something in that's going to increase your security from a potential police raid or however they're selling it, and then a week later, like, put in something that's going to completely get rid of that. Some of the interesting, more hypotheticals was if this relies on, your retina actually looking at the screen, then that is something that goes back to the Fifth Amendment question, and that's where the line gets really gray of whether they can compel you to look at something, because looking is kind of a mix between something you know and something you are. It's your eyes, but it's an activity. It's a revelation that you actively have to do. So I think that would be really interesting in terms of the security concerns and all of this, or the concerns that this is going to be used, that facial recognition is going to be used to increase, police activity and tracking. I just think that there's a lot more that's already going on. And there's, you know, there's articles that cite that there's half of people's faces are already in databases for police to use and all of this. So my concern is like is less, you know, the rule of law and how Congress wants to put that in place and that limits the police is much more helpful to stopping that than, you know, questioning companies like Apple in terms of, you know, how they're using their personal product or how they're using their product. Even though Apple's a big player, like ultimately, like the question is it legal for the police to do this? And that's something, at least on the federal level, that's up for Congress to decide.
Right. Here's a good portion from an Atlantic article we have in our discussion points, talking about the demarcation that Mike mentioned earlier, where things that you know are protected under the Fifth Amendment, but things that you are not, and talking about the disagreement that there should be that demarcation. They write that the fact that a physical attribute is used for unlocking a device changes how it should be treated under the law, the argument goes. When you put your fingerprint on the phone, you're actually communicating something. Albert Ghadari, the director of privacy at Stanford University's Center for Internet and Society, told the author of this piece last year, "You're saying, hi, it's me, please open up. That communication should be protected under the Fifth Amendment, just like a password," he said. "And the same would hold for any other way of unlocking your phone using physical characteristics, including facial recognition." Mike, do you see courts maybe starting to agree with Albert Ghadari?
I don't know about that. That doesn't seem like a very persuasive argument to me. I mean, couldn't you say the same thing about a blood sample that, hey, a blood sample is saying, hey, it's me, you know, here's a sample of my blood or hair. If I'm understanding the argument correctly, he's saying that this would fall more into the realm of a fingerprint password would fall more into the realm of what you know or some sort of communicative act. Mm-hmm. I don't buy it. But then again, as we've talked about before, I don't know that I buy the whole line of demarcation between these two anyway.
Yeah.
You know, you're not communicating a fact in the sense of communicating anything other than information that's going to unlock a phone. And whether that's done through a passcode or through a fingerprint, I'm not sure that the distinction matters. And that may just show my Fifth Amendment ignorance. But, you know, at the end of the day, you're getting to the same point, a slightly different vehicle or methodology. But, you know, I'm not sure that I'm persuaded at the end of the day that there's a huge distinction between the two.
Yeah. Again, it's good to live in interesting times. The other fascinating part of all of this with to me is what exactly these face prints are, because they're not photographs. They're mapped with the very sophisticated camera technology built into this phone. And they're a unique thing, and you know, how will they be used, and what will the fate of them be? I think remains to be seen. Any final thoughts, Matt?
No, I agree with you completely that this is a computer algorithm of a photo where it's taking it and manipulating it into bits, and then recognizing it based on the certain patterns. I think it's an incredibly, incredibly cool technology, but like all incredibly, incredibly cool technologies, there's going to be some downside into it, and it'll be interesting how the law evolves around that.
Yep. Amber, any final thoughts on this?
I agree with what everybody said. I think this one's going to be a key one to watch, and we're only going to see more and more facial recognition out there, so it'll be really a big test to see how this pans out.
Mike, you?
I guess the only other thought I would mention, we'd be remiss to not mention that when this technology was displayed earlier this week, it didn't work, right?
Oh, really?
So I understand that the reason that happened is multiple faces, the phone that was being, I guess, shuttled over to the the lead engineer that was demonstrating the technology. It sounds like maybe multiple faces looked into the phone, and as a result, it defaulted to the passcode unlocking mechanism. So when he was up there in front of the whole crowd displaying the facial recognition unlocking method, it didn't work. So
like a security feature locking out of your account if there have been too many failed password attempts, that kind of thing.
That was my understanding.
Yeah. Yes,
too many faces were looking at the phone, I guess.
Ah. Yes, that does bear mentioning. Let us just follow up on something we discussed last week. Lots of people emailed that they enjoyed the asset forfeiture discussion, that that's been an issue that's been on their mind and something that they're curious about what's happening with. So just to bring you up to speed, one thing that is happening with that, we mentioned last week, we talked about Jeff Sessions' Justice Department undoing the prior administration's reforms where asset forfeiture wouldn't be as easy or expansive to get. Jeff Sessions and the Justice Department wanted to roll that back and make it easier and more expansive to get asset forfeiture. But Congress had a surprise for us this week. The House of Representatives on Tuesday approved an amendment to the Make America Secure and Prosperous Appropriations Act. And that amendment would roll back the expansion of the asset forfeiture. So a bit of a cat and mouse going on with our lawmakers on this issue. Also notably, the amendment passed with a voice vote, which means it had overwhelming support. So I guess ball's back in your court, Justice Department, about how you're going to expand asset forfeiture if you're going to be able to do it. Amber, have you been paying attention to this?
Yeah, only a little bit. But I think the narrative that you laid out is pretty much what we're seeing in Congress on a lot of issues, where the executive branch wants to do something, they announce it, Congress decides, no, we're going to weigh in here. I think we're seeing more pushback from Congress about what DOJ and other agencies are doing than we have in the beginning of Trump's administration.
Right. We talked about this last week in the context of the fact that Kim.com actually is seeking review from the Supreme Court over whether all of his assets could be seized in this way when he's none of those assets are in the U.S. and he's never been to the U.S. So I think that's an interesting little twist. Let us move on. Since we're already talking about some legislation, regulation and policy, let's talk about more of it. So one of your many beats at Law 360, Amber, as we discussed at the top of the show, is immigration. And we've done a bit of monitoring the immigration developments this last year because of the tech industry's strong interest in and advocacy about those issues. We could talk a bit about what has happened this week with DACA, because it's been kind of interesting, and also because tech companies, including Apple, Google, Facebook, Microsoft, have all come out in favor of DACA, and they do not want people that they are employing who are protected under the law right now to lose those protections. So can you bring us up to speed there a bit?
Oh, man, it has been a wild ride, as it has been for the last 6 months or so on various immigration issues. I've actually covered immigration in some capacity, either as a reporter or managing a team of reporters, for the better part of a decade. And this is among the craziest times I've ever seen. So where we are now, I think most people have seen this just in the broad media coverage. Trump decided to roll back DACA, which is a program that was an Obama executive action that would protect from deportation and give work permits to certain young immigrants who were brought here as children through no choice of their own. And that was in place for a while. It had been going very well. It had broad support, not just from Democrats, but also from Republicans. As you said, it had broad support from the tech companies and really the business community at large. And the reason Trump took this action, he campaign on it saying, you know, he's a hardliner on immigration. So he'd been saying that he would potentially do this, but then waited a while until Texas and a group of other states threatened to sue if he didn't take action to end DACA. So with the threat of that looming over his head, either the Justice Department would have had to have defended a program Trump and Jeff Sessions don't particularly like, or they had to go ahead and roll it back. And so they chose to roll it back. They did it in a little bit of an unusual way where it's a phased end to the program, which means that I'm sure you guys have heard this generally in the news. There's what they're calling the 6-month window where not a lot is going to happen to these young people. And during that time, the hope was that Congress would step in and act on DACA once and for all. That's an uphill climb. We've had some reporting from Law 360. A variety of our reporters have been covering this extensively. And the concept of Congress stepping in the 6 months, there's some will for that there. There's not just Democrats who very much want these young people protected, but there's also some Republicans who would like to see this sorted out once and for all. But Congress has just a stacked agenda right now, and that makes this really tough. They have things that are must-pass things like debt ceiling, the budget. They keep talking about, the Republicans keep talking about diving into tax reform. All of this makes it very complicated to then find the time to deal with a contentious immigration issue that's tough even in the best of circumstances.
Okay, so we'll continue to watch that. It appears like things might be getting closer to finding a way for the DACA folks covered under DACA to stay in the country, right, based on news this week.
So this week, what's happened was just a little weird, honestly. Pelosi and Schumer met with Donald Trump, and then shortly after that meeting, they had a dinner. They came out, released a press release saying, we've reached an agreement, basically in principle. Nothing was firm, but we've reached a way for these, they call them the dreamers, these so-called dreamers to remain in the country, and we will work with the Trump administration and the Republicans on some enforcement measures that will go along with that. And that was how the coalition was going to deal with it. Then Donald Trump got a lot of blowback from people for that and came out and said, no, we don't have a deal. I still want the border wall. That hasn't been agreed to. Just today he tweeted about how no deal on these DACA recipients could be reached if there was anything that was related to chain migration. So he's now sort of backtracking on how much of a deal they have. And Republicans are kind of mad about this. I mean, they wanted to use fixing this issue for the Dreamers as a bit of a incentive to get some things they wanted out of the Democrats. So they essentially wanted it as a bargaining chip. And it's unclear where we stand right now about how that's going to be sorted out. I think the issue is that Trump probably wants to deal with this and have it off his plate, but Republicans in Congress are really the ones that have to step up here now that he's rolled back the executive action on it. So we've got to get a deal between Mitch McConnell, Paul Ryan, and then the Democrats on the other side.
Right. And then the other thing that happened this week is a temporary restoration of the travel ban by the Supreme Court, pending its full consideration of the Ninth Circuit's action. Any thoughts there?
So many thoughts there as well.
Yeah.
So I actually, as you would imagine, we're following this pretty closely as well at Law 360. Yeah. And we, for my podcast, we're lucky enough to talk to former acting Solicitor General Ian Gershengorn. We're going to have that episode coming out right around the time the Supreme Court kicks back into gear. And we talked about this travel ban case. And there's a lot to this one. There are substantive things that will have to be addressed by the court if they get that far. And Ian Gershengorn was making an argument that some of this may be moot by the time the court is actually hearing it, because there were set windows in that executive order about the travel ban to assess how migration and how these immigrants and the vetting was being done to decide whether or not to let them into the country. So if we outpace those windows that close, I think, at the end of this month and then another one's in October, there may be an argument that this whole case is moot. So if I were a betting person, I would say that the Supreme Court will actually take this up in a more focusing more on the merits of, was this a a ban that violates the rights of these people because it's essentially based on religion? Or is this really within the purview of the president because of his broad national security powers? So I think we'll get to that argument. But what we're left with in this time now, and we've been left with it all summer, the Supreme Court had reinstated part of the ban. Now they're chipping back through and reinstating other parts. So we just have a tumultuous, murky period now until they have oral arguments in October and hopefully reach a decision shortly thereafter.
Right. And that'll be on October 10th for anyone who wants to mark their calendars for that. Other interesting piece we have in the rundown here, not directly related to the travel ban and whether it stays or goes, but related to vetting at the border and people coming in from all countries, really. CNN has some reporting that talks about what the Customs and Border Protection folks are going to be due. Their Deputy Commissioner, Ronard Vitiello, was at a security conference in Washington this week and was specifically calling out things like social media, looking at smartphones into people's backgrounds and their activity. So I guess this ties in to, you know, very concretely with what can be done at borders and what technology will or will not permit border agents to do at borders. Just it looks like an indication from the administration and from Border Patrol, Customs and Border Patrol, that these things are very much on their radar and seem fruitful to scrutinize. They're also working on continuous vetting. Once someone gets a valid visa for the United States, the vetting shouldn't stop, they say. What are they doing 6 months from now? What are they involved in 6 months from now? That's a big piece of this. That's from Acting Immigration and Customs Enforcement Director Tom Homan. So I don't think that this sort of, we've talked about cat and mouse for asset forfeiture, cat and mouse between people, their devices, and scrutiny by either Homeland Security or Customs or law enforcement in general is going to go away anytime soon, right, Amber?
It's definitely not going to go away. And this is a really tricky one. Customs officers have some pretty broad powers to do this sort of vetting. And Trump has said repeatedly, he's never wavered from saying extreme vetting is what he wants for all immigrants and really anyone crossing our borders. So it leads to a lot of downstream problems. I mean, there's the initial privacy concerns about whether or not they should be able to access all of your social media accounts, other things on your electronic devices. And basically, they do have that authority and they're going to push forward in doing it. But it also brings up something that I think is a little more relevant for some of the people watching this show because they're interested in tech issues and what's going on with big tech companies, because businesses now have to think about things like, so I have someone who's on a visa, they go on a work trip somewhere and they take a laptop that belongs to the company. It may have sensitive information, trade secrets, what have you, on the laptop. How much are these agents going to be able to dig into that information? And how do you protect yourself from those kind of issues when you know this extreme vetting is happening every time someone comes back into the country?
Right. And we, you know, not only do companies have to worry about that with their employees, but they have to worry about it with their consumers. And we've already discussed Apple building features into its operating system that at least partially addresses that issue. So fascinating stuff. Mike Keyes, anything you want to add?
Boy, no, I think you both really, really covered it. I agree. It's fascinating, interesting issues, and we'll see how this all plays out.
Matt Curtis?
Yeah, I think that the only difference between, you know, Apple's use, the use of an Apple product to protect yourself in the customs situation, and different than a police officer, is that if they ask for your password and you're not willing to give it to a custom agent, they're just not going to let you in the country. So the implications are not that you're protected by the Fifth Amendment, but that you don't get to go where you wanted to go. but that just has to do with the broad executive power in terms of national security, which has plus and minuses, and ultimately that's why it matters who you're voting for.
All right, let us move on. Matt noticed an interesting patent development this week, so let's get to that. Matt, tell us about drug patents and tribes.
Okay, so just to give a little background, in 2011, the Congress enacted the American Invents Act, which vastly put in provisions to vastly streamline the evaluation of patents. And so it typically takes about a year and a half to evaluate whether a patent is valid or not in an administrative procedure called the PTAB. Now, universities, through their state sovereignty, have argued and were able to get sovereign immunity from this administrative procedure because this is not an Article III judicial procedure, which you're able to bring against states in most circumstances, but this is an Article I court. So the distinction matters there because Native American tribes are also not – they also have sovereign immunity. It's a little hazy in terms of if that is coextensive with a state, but in some areas it is. So a pharmaceutical company who was concerned that their patent would be invalidated essentially set up a holding company within a Native American tribe and paid them several million dollars. And now they are trying to argue that they do not have to go through the administrative procedure and therefore will just be able to hold their patent for longer. This is like in terms of a design of law that individuals with vast stakes can evade a procedure, a fair procedure that is just going to basically say, do you have a right to the patent? Is it non-obvious? Is it going through the basic steps to get a patent? And they can evade that and get monopoly rights for years. 7-8 years by going through the typical judicial process is very, very problematic.
Mm-hmm. And this came up in the context of a drug patent, but there's no reason why it has to stay in that context, right?
Yeah, but it's most likely to be a drug patent because drug patents are just the ones that are that valuable. If you look at tech mm-hmm. and those sort of patents, those patent disputes are like they're not just single patent disputes. They're multiple patent disputes, and they're hundreds. You know, I think the average phone has 250,000 patents that are relevant to it. So it's probably not as likely to happen in other industries. Drugs are, you know, you're talking about billion in multi-billion dollar patents that every month, every year is just incredibly valuable, where that's not true as much in other fields.
Okay, Amber, this is up your alley too. Anything you want to add?
This is right up my alley, guys. This one's really interesting because it's such a clever thing that they've done here, and now we have to see how the PTAB and the courts deal with it. I think that Matt is right. It's going to be very potentially the floodgates are open in the pharma sector, but mm-hmm. it maybe won't spread as quickly to tech. That all depends on money, though. So if this becomes really lucrative for tribes, they will come up with different deal structures that might induce more people to shield patents in this way unless this gets nipped in the bud. So I have some reporters who've been writing some analysis pieces about this, and they've looked at how this deal will sort of hold up and if this is different from what's happened with the universities. And part of that is this deal was created after the IPR, which is the procedure at the PTAB, had already been initiated on this patent. So there's some argument to be made that the immunity maybe doesn't attach at this point because this deal was designed just to take advantage of that immunity. So it'll be interesting to see how that gets argued. And then it seems like this is also something where you would imagine the Federal Circuit, which hears patent cases and appeals from PTAB, would be involved. But there's a question about whether or not that can actually happen because the Federal Circuit several times has said that a board's decision to institute, the PTAB's decision to institute a review of a patent can't be appealed to them. So we may have a situation where they found this clever workaround and the Federal Circuit may decide they don't have the jurisdiction to really intervene.
Go ahead, Matt, and then I have a thought.
And we have to understand that going up to the Supreme Court in this next term is whether the IPR in general is constitutional. There's a case that basically argues that you cannot take property rights away from somebody through an Article I court, which is an administrative court. And there's an 1897 case that says that. It'll be interesting to see whether they uphold that case or dance around it or actually overrule it.
Yeah, something that's a little interesting about that, and just for a wonky nerd like me, I find this so great. There's a question of whether or not the English Privy Council and whether or not they would have had the rights to do that impacts that case, because it might turn on whether or not at the time this was all set up in the U.S. that those rights were based on common law. And so that comes into play here, too. So that's just a nerd out kind of moment. It's even in the weeds for me, and I'm the kind of person.
This is the way patent goes, because Lexmark was decided on the basis of Sir Edward Coke, which is a 16th century jurist from England. So.
And I mean, I will also say this. I, around the office, got kind of a little bit of a reputation where I sort of walked around for a year saying, guys, what if TC Heartland really does upend patent venue? Wouldn't that be crazy? We'd have so many stories to write. It'd be so exciting for us. And I feel like I almost like hexed that case, because it seemed crazy at the time that they really would completely upend venue in the way that they actually did. So now I'm walking around the office saying, oh, with this oil states case, what if AIA reviews, what if those just get canned? What happens then? So there's a little secretive part of me that wants to see it all go crazy, because it's just so interesting. I try not to bet on what the Supreme Court will do, but I will be a bit surprised if they scrap this altogether. It's just celebrated its 5th year anniversary. It's now become a really ensconced part of the patent law landscape. So I would be surprised if it's completely chucked out.
Boz in IRC is asking, does the public interest come into play here? It seems to go against that, which was sort of along the lines of what I was thinking. This was all reminding me of our discussion in the context of Dr. Phil and rushing to the copyright office to register your 9 seconds of video that's just a small part of a whole, just so you can sue over that 9 seconds in a way that copyright law never intended. It seems like this is going to smack whoever reviews it as gamesmanship and exploiting a loophole that was not designed to be exploited in this way, and that someone's going to patch that loophole one way or the other. I don't know if it's going to take the Privy Council to do it. This shall not pass is sort of the reaction I'm having.
There's a real question, though, of why is it okay for states to – I mean, they have massive university systems that are running as businesses, and that they're able to avoid – I mean, and businesses that are doing the basic research of our country, that they're able to avoid whether their patent is valid or not for years on end, doesn't make any sense either. So hopefully if this comes on review, they'll review the whole system of sovereign immunity for patent. The Article I court, the patent is actually granting them the right. So it seems improbable that they can't decide to revoke it on the basis of more evidence.
Right. Hey, Mike, anything you want to add?
Yeah, a couple of things. So I think Amber's point about how the IPR process was already started with respect to the Allergan patent issue, I think that could be pretty significant, because I mean, it clearly makes it look like this was just an end run around the IPR process and that they were trying to evade it. And so this may not be the most ideal test case to assess whether tribal sovereign immunity trumps the IPR process. I guess the other thing is, even though tribes have historically been considered their own sovereign nations, the U.S. Supreme Court and certainly Congress over the course of many decades – has eroded that sovereign immunity to an extent. And so we'll see ultimately, where this goes. But it's clearly fascinating.
It is. One other thing that I
wanted to mention, I was listening to NPR this morning, Marketplace, a story by David Brancaccio. And I came away from that story thinking, this sounds like they're talking about this will somehow extend the life of the patent. It's not an extension. It's not like it's going to add years or extend the term by any means. It's simply just whether a tribe would be subject to this IPR process. So mm-hmm. I think that's an important clarification.
But its effect is to extend the monopoly, though, because a competitor isn't going to come in with a competing drug if it hasn't been able to win its case.
I understand that, but it's not going to add life onto the patent. I mean, and Matt, correct me, and Amber, correct me if I'm wrong, but there's other ways to challenge a patent than through the IPR process. You can do it the old-fashioned way, right? Can't you just go right to federal court and challenge it, or is that just not possible anymore?
No, you're exactly right there. You can go to district court to challenge it.
And so the IPR process is just a more truncated, quicker way to do it, or at least in theory.
In practice it is, because you're looking at the difference between an 8 or 9 year proceeding, unless you're in the Eastern District of Texas, which was truncated compared to the normal one, or versus a year and a half proceeding. Mandated by law, and they're actually upholding that timeline. The difference in terms of when people are getting to market is just massive. It's essentially granting you additional protections versus not having it go through trial. It's also massively like less expensive to bring it through the IPR. So it makes it much – so a competitor is much more likely to challenge the validity of a patent, where if it was going to be a couple million dollars versus $100,000, I don't know exactly what the numbers are. But in terms of consumer welfare, your competitors are less likely to challenge it because they can't justify the ROI on it.
So yeah, while I understand
all of that's
sorry,
right.
Go ahead.
And now I was just gonna say all of that's right that Matt was laying out there. And one thing we do see a lot is actually proceedings in both venues. So we'll see something going on at PTAB and the same patents also moving through the district courts.
Got it. And I understand that it's very important. This is a key issue. I'm so glad we've fleshed it out on the show about whether drug patents are going to be used in a monopolistic way, and whether or not ancient British common law is going to come into play. But is it really as important as whether or not a competing burger joint is going to be able to call its offerings the triple double or the triple triple double double? That's what we have on deck next. And of course, that's in the realm of trademarks. Pretty much whenever there's a legal dispute involving In-N-Out Burger, I'm going to have to throw it in the show because just it makes me envision lovely, lovely double doubles with cheese dancing in front of my face. And so that's why we're talking about this on today's show, that and the fact that Mike is a trademark maven. And there's some pretty interesting issues involved in this dispute between In-N-Out Burger and Smash Burger. Regarding whether Smash Burger can register certain trademarks based on trademarks that In-N-Out already has. And there's a federal lawsuit that also is involved on these issues too. But what really fascinates me is that some of the trademarks here are not the triple triple specifically is not something that is ever affirmatively marketed by In-N-Out. It's something on the secret menu and maybe secretly available in an online way only. And you're not going to see it on their signage. You're not going to see it on their marketing, despite apparently there's some question about whether the burger bags at issue that are specimens before the USPTO are in use or not, or maybe are older and therefore not part of current marketing. But I think it's fascinating that we're having a trademark dispute, Mike, about something that is secret. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, it makes perfect sense. The way you've teed it up makes perfect sense. I also agree that, it raises an interesting trademark issue, I suppose. I mean, of course, trademark rights are obtained by a company or by an individual, for that matter, only if you use them in connection with a good or service in commerce. So you actually have to promote your goods and services in some meaningful way with the trademark in question in order to obtain rights in that mark. So the fact that Triple may not have been marketed at all, or maybe just limited, raises the question of whether In-N-Out can claim trademark rights in Triple to begin with. Even though consumers of the product may know that you can go up and order a Triple or may know about it, that doesn't necessarily mean that the company has trademark rights associated with it.
Right. It's like the FTC telling influencers who think everybody knows everything. No, they don't. Not everybody knows about the Triple. In fact, I don't believe I knew about the Triple until we started discussing it today, although I did know about the secret menu and animal style, of course. Anyway, just wanted to bring it up. It is not as weighty an issue as the patent issues we were slogging through a moment ago, but I think it's fun and appetizing. Amber, any thoughts?
Yeah, I think it also brings up some issues about whether or not that is just a descriptive term instead of an actual something you'd actually have trademark rights in, because you can't get rights for trademarks if it's just descriptive. So is double or triple just descriptive? And then there's a question too of, all right, so if you think it's not just descriptive and that they have used it enough in commerce to have the trademark rights, is there an argument to be made that maybe we're slipping into the genericide argument here, where Triple is something that maybe is being used by others in a way that isn't associated with In-N-Out and has just become a generic term for that type of burger. So there's a lot of a little twist to this one.
Yeah, I think it's fascinating too that involved in all this is not just what's on the menu when you walk in the store, but the company's app, the In-N-Out app, and also its website, and how it sort of lets people know that this secret menu or not so secret menu exists. Matt, any thoughts? Oh, I think you're muted.
I think that the triple is unique and wonderful and should be given any rights it wants. I think that they both cover the intellectual points more interestingly. My stomach just really wants one. So
I think you just described a unicorn. It's unique and wonderful and should be given any rights it wants. Long live the triple will be our second MCLE passphrase for this episode of This Week in Law. If you need some information about CLE credit and applying for credit in your jurisdiction, you can head on over to our wiki at wiki.twit.tv. Find our This Week in Law page there, and there is a 50-state chart for the United States that we hope will give you some guidance and assistance. I think we're ready to move into our concluding material for the show. And in keeping with our trademark story, we have doubles of everything today. So let's start with our animal selfie of the week. I think it's only appropriate that the week that the PETA case before the Ninth Circuit settles, that we have two animal selfies where folks could ponder what rights, if any, the animals in these photos had. Our first was submitted by listener Bryant Thompson, and I was doing a little research to try and find the provenance of this particular photo. It is a very contemplative primate of some sort, I am not sure the species, holding a Nikon in the non-selfie position. And I was not able to find out whether another monkey took this photo or a human photographer. Clearly, the human photographer has been deprived of one of its tools here. But I did find a Reddit thread on it that is notable only for the fact that someone launched a Photoshop battle from this particular photo. And there is another photo where the contemplative monkey is floating in space and holding a globe instead of a camera and saying, "No one is alone in this world." There we go, if you're watching the video. And various other entries into the Photoshop battle of the contemplative monkey. So, well, technically, perhaps not an animal selfie. We don't know much about how that photo was taken, or at least I don't at this point. That was our submission from a listener, and I like it a good deal. We have another sort of questionable whether I have any actual animal selfies here to share with you, but there was an incident in Aspen, Colorado this week where there were a trio of black bears that set up camp in a tree in the middle of town, and many, many people were photographing the bears, and then the bears came down, and this is the culture that we're living in today, folks. Despite the fact that the police were trying hard to keep people away from the bears because bears can be dangerous, the bears were being surrounded and followed by picture takers, especially people getting close enough for selfies with the bears. The cubs actually wound up being separated from the mother. There was a mother and two cubs. The situation escalated when the bears tried to make a break for it and were pursued by video takers. That's when the cubs got separated from the mothers. So I have not actually seen any animal selfies or human taken selfies with the animals that resulted from all of this, thank goodness. So no, I was not able to quickly find any episode or any evidence of folks being rewarded for interfering with the bears here. But the Aspen police were quick to point out that you shouldn't be doing this. It's harmful to the animals and harmful to you, and leave the bears alone. So although I don't think PETA would weigh into this one, the police did find a way to get involved. Our tips of the week are twofold. One of them involves pharmaceuticals, actually, hearkening back to our patent discussion. And the tip itself is don't solicit assault, which is something that got Martin Shkreli, is that how we say his name? Shkreli?
Shkreli.
The pharmaceutical CEO who is in all kinds of trouble and awaiting sentencing. He was out on bail while he was awaiting sentencing, but no more. He has been sent back to jail because of something he posted on Facebook. What he posted on Facebook read as follows: "The Clinton Foundation is willing to kill to protect its secrets. So on HRC's book tour, try to grab a hair from her. I must confirm the sequences I have. I will pay $5,000 per hair obtained from Hillary Clinton." He too, like the Bart Simpsons we discussed earlier, said, "How could you not see that I was joking?" The court had no problem seeing that someone could have taken him quite seriously here and tried to assault former Secretary Clinton, sent the man to jail at the prosecutor's request. So don't solicit assault. This also reminds me of that incident we've discussed on the show a couple of times where the strobing, flashing GIF was sent to the reporter with epilepsy. So your online actions can have real world assault ramifications. And this is just another example. Matt, any thoughts on this?
Only that I just think that like Shkreli just needs to become an adjective that we use for like a series of bad decisions. But because this guy just like can't get anything right, and like, yeah. So no thoughts on it. I just think it's weird and disgusting, and
and he's in jail. Amber?
Yeah.
Oh, we have followed Shkreli and his antics more than I'd like to admit at Law 360. We've had reporters that followed his whole trial, were there every day and came out talking about it. And this just falls in line with everything we know about him. He had jurors at that trial. The voir dire took quite some time. They had to go through about 200 people to get 12 that were not biased, because they were all saying things like, yeah, I don't really know much about this guy, but I came in here and he just looks like a liar to me. So it was that kind of sentiment that just follows him around. And this is another example of his provocateur personification there.
Yep. His lawyer in the course of trying to keep him out of jail for this, said something to the press about, we'd just prefer that he not talk to the press because he has no filter. So please, press, help us out. He seemed to be begging. Mike, any thoughts?
No, nothing further from here.
That's probably
good advice from his lawyer.
Yes. So in keeping with our double-double theme of the day, our second tip of the week. Remember, we had Josh Browder on the show. He created the Do Not Pay app to fight parking tickets. He has now created a bot that will help you. It's the same bot, Do Not Pay, but now it will help you sue Equifax in small claims court in any of the 50 United States. It fills in all the necessary forms, and all you have to do is serve them on Equifax. Now, that could be a big hurdle for people, but it's not that hard. And then show up in court. And you could recover up to from between $2,500 in some states with low small claims caps to up to $25,000 in Tennessee. So if you are interested, the Do Not Pay bot is looking to help you out in going after Equifax for its breach. Matt, any thoughts on this?
Yeah, I think that this is a really interesting question in terms of the unauthorized practice of law, whether the act of filing, automated filing, is something that's going to be allowed. I think that it should be, and you know, you just have to know that the risk is that the bot is not going to, you know, completely get your story the way you want it to, and you should certainly look at it. But in terms of a way to bring small claims court, it's really hard to hire an attorney. Just because of the cost of it. So I think that, I'm a fan of it, and I hope that if this does come up in an unauthorized practice of law, that a court gets it right and decides that, this is something that can be reviewed by an individual before they bring it to small claims court.
Right. They still have to go to court and advocate for themselves, anyone who wants to take advantage of this. Mike or Amber, anything you want to add?
What a bad time Equifax has been having, guys. Yeah, we actually are talking about them on Pro Se in our episode that releases this weekend. And in addition to bots filing lawsuits against them, consumers, the SEC looking into them, the FTC looking into this hack, they're also potentially going to face some investor lawsuits, which may be the first of their kind to get real traction after a hack and a data breach. So that's going to be really interesting as that plays out in the courts.
Yeah, absolutely. Our final double-double is our doubled-up resources. We have two for you. One is the Pro Se podcast, which is Amber and her colleagues' podcast over at Law 360. We've heard a bit about it on the show. As she mentioned, you do not have to sign up for Law 360. You do not have to be a LexisNexis subscriber. You can listen in just the way you're listening to our show right now. And we hope you'll go enjoy the show. Anything else you want to add about Pro Se, Amber?
No, I think you did a great job explaining it. I would just tell people again, share it wide, far and wide. It's outside of our paywall, so anybody can listen to it. Lawyers will like it, I think. But also, we try to keep it light and lively, so even the non-lawyers who are just interested in the issues are going to find it fun, I think.
Good. We're right there with you. We try to do the same thing. Copyright or Wrong is our second resource of the week. This was submitted by a listener too. This was via Keith Sunstep, and it is on BBC Radio. It is free to listen to. It is about 28 minutes long, and it is by copyright lawyer and author Richard Taylor. And it's an in-depth look and a really nice look with all kinds of good examples and deep thought about the problems with copyright law and how it has had trouble. And this is why we've been able to do almost 11 years worth of shows that often involve copyright issues and their intersection with technology, that technology and copyright are often at odds, and that current copyright regimes just aren't set up to really deal with how technology has evolved and is being used and will be used in the future. So it's a neat 28 minutes of your time going deep on copyright law and really questioning whether reform is necessary or maybe tossing the whole regime out. So I encourage you to check that out. And thank you so much, Keith, for pointing it out to all of us. And with that, I think we've actually made it through most of the show that we intended to get to. Any stories that we didn't get to this week, we'll certainly think about getting to next week. So if something happened this week that you're dying, wondering why on earth we didn't get to it, we have a limited amount of time. We already have a really long show, and we're thrilled to be able to go deep on the issues that we do, and we'll try and get to anything that we missed next week. In the meantime, I just want to say thank you so much to Amber McKinney for being with us. It's been a pleasure meeting you, Amber. So glad to have had this discussion.
Thanks so much. It's been really fun to be on the show with you guys today.
We've mentioned Pro Se, we've mentioned Law 360. Anything else that you're working on or involved in that you want to let people know about before we sign off for the day?
Guys, I was just so excited about Pro Se. That was my big thing to talk about today. I think you've hit all the things for me. Thanks a lot.
Wonderful. Great meeting you. Great having you on. Mike Keyes, always great chatting with you.
Oh, that was a blast. I really enjoyed being with everybody today. And thanks so much, Amber, for carving out time to be with us. And I would plug Pro Se as well. I think it's a great podcast. You guys are doing great things. And congrats to you and Bill and Alex for a job well done. We'll keep listening over here.
Thanks a lot, Mike.
Absolutely. And Matt Curtis, great chatting with you again today.
Thank you, and I got a good podcast to walk as or to listen to as I go on my walk right now. So look forward to listening to Amber, and thanks for being on, and thanks as always, Mike and Denise.
You're very welcome, and thanks too to our listeners and viewers who join us, whether you join us all the time or are just tuning in for the first time. We're really glad that you did. We hope that you'll come back. We record the show every Friday at 11 o'clock Pacific time, 1800 UTC. And it's always really fun if you can join us live. We have live chat with our audience where you can interact with us, tell us what's on your mind in real time as we're doing the show. We really appreciate that too, because there are often times where we need to fact check things on the fly, et cetera. And IRC, you're so valuable to us, both to keep us accurate and on track and to keep us laughing. There's always good humor in IRC. So thanks for all of that. But don't worry about it. If you can't join us live, you can head on over to our show page at twit.tv/twill. Our whole archive of shows is there, and we're excited for you to delve into them, enjoy them at your leisure and on your device of choice. Instructions and suggestions for how you can enjoy the show on your own time and on your own device, whether you're running around in life or kicking back on the couch. There are wonderful ways to enjoy all of our TWIT programs. So we're just glad that you do. Please continue to get in touch with us between the shows. That's actually the highlight of my week, when I hear about people who are feeding back to us about things we've discussed on the show, things they liked, things they disagreed with, things they wish that we'd gone deeper on. All of it. Send it our way. I'm Denise at twit.tv. Mike is Mike at twit.tv. Matt is Matt C at twit.tv. You can find us on Twitter. You can find us on Facebook. All great places to reach out to us. Let us know too who you think you'd like to see on the show with us, because we're always looking for great, interesting, scintillating people to invite on the show. And we're not afraid to invite just about anyone. You know, their notoriety and or fame and or busyness really doesn't ever prevent us from reaching out to them and at least giving it a try. So, if you think we should take a flyer, throw a name in front of us, and we just might do it, and we might just get them on the show. Yay, that's always fun and exciting when it happens. So thrilled that you've all been with us here today. Thanks so much again to Amber McKinney, Mike Keyes, and Matt Curtis. And we will see you next week on This Week in Law. Until then, take care.